Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action. That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today.
The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Samantha Schroeder, Deputy Director of FedSoc Films. What did one of our founding philosophers have to say about religious toleration? Today we're joined by two professors from the film, Paul Carice and Michael Zuckert, for a spirited discussion on this important issue. Welcome to the show and thanks for being on with us.
Thanks, Samantha. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Samantha.
I'll start by asking, who was John Locke and why did the American founding fathers care about him?
A related concept that we mentioned is Locke's idea of religious liberty, that we don't really much understand or read the letter on toleration or the debates about toleration. We're sort of living off that legacy, but our universities don't teach it, study it very much. Even political science and philosophy and history departments don't. And so it's not in the broader political culture. It's not in the schools. So talk a little bit about what was so striking and innovative about Locke's letter on toleration, the controversies about it, and how it's received in America.
Yeah, good point. One of the things that we need to remember that's sometimes forgotten is that the Lockean philosophy and a lot of what we think of as a liberal tradition, liberal in the old sense, not so much contemporary sense, much of that tradition was forged as a response to the religious conflict in the post-Reformation world in Europe, where there had been religious wars going on for a long time. And as I mentioned yesterday in our podcast, there was a civil war in England, which was set off by this, by the Reformation. And there were likewise wars on the continent. And so the whole question of religious of what to do about religion, how the political authorities ought to deal with religion, how this conflict over what is the true political implications of the Reformation on the one hand, or the true political implications of the true religion, whatever one thought that might be, what those would be. Those questions were agitating political life in a way that was not merely severe, but was downright bloody. And so Locke's doctrine of toleration, he was not by any means the only one who was looking for a solution to the religion problem. But he did formulate perhaps the most widely accepted and the most persuasive account of religious toleration. So when he was in Holland in the 1680s, he formulated this so-called letter on toleration, which was itself to some degree based on the experience that he saw around him in the Netherlands. Holland was indeed one of the more tolerant places in Europe, and it showed him, as well as it showed some other people, that a society based on toleration was possible. It had been thought by many others that what one needed to make political society work was a consensus about the most important things, and therefore that led to an attempt to impose religious belief, a uniform religious belief on the society. But Holland showed, and Locke came to believe, that that was not necessary. So what Locke tried to show was that political authority and religious authority were, if not completely, almost completely separate things. And that the sovereign, the magistrate, as Locke put it, the magistrate had no authority in religious matters. And that's partly on the basis of his story about the formation of government. That is why we come to formulate government. We don't formulate government in order to save each other's souls. Saving our souls is an individual matter between us and God in whatever way, in what way we think is the true way. And the state has nothing particularly to add to that, to contribute to it. In fact, Locke says when the state tries to intervene, it's almost always intervening for the wrong reasons. Not to save your soul, but to save the prince's authority. So that's on the one side. The political authority has nothing to do with religion. And on the other side, he makes the case that true worship must be sincere worship. It can't be coerced worship in any form. And therefore, there's no gain from a religious perspective in imposing religion on somebody. All you can do is you can force them to go through the motions, but you can't force them to believe in their hearts and believe sincerely. And so Locke makes this a strong case. The state should stay out of religion. And there's no gain to religion for that, and there's no gain to the state from trying to impose religious authority on believers or non-believers.
And in the 1680s in Europe, and then, you know, 80 plus years later in America, the issue is not just Protestant and Catholic, it's the diversity of Protestant communities that had developed in the preceding century and more. And so the signal influence of this, especially Locke's version of an argument on toleration for the Americans, shows up in the Constitution itself, even before the First Amendment, that there's the clause which occasionally comes into the news, especially these days when there's a judicial confirmation afoot in the land for a senior federal appellate court over the Supreme Court. The clause in Article 6 of the Constitution that there shall be no religious test for office. This is an embodiment of a sort of condensed expression of Locke's argument. And then the two clauses in the First Amendment. But I did want to raise again, I'm the official devil's advocate here. I wanted to raise one of the controversies, actually two controversies about Locke and the letter concerning toleration. One would be, in what way is this argument from Locke really cleverly, secretly hostile to religion? It's not on the surface of the text, but in fact, you can't make this kind of argument, say the critics, as Locke makes it, to totally separate questions of the human soul from the formation of politics, the cultural spirit, so to speak, of politics. You can't do that unless you really think religion's a problem and it has to sort of be segregated and separated so that it's covertly an anti-religious, anti-Christian text. I think you don't agree with that, but
yeah, let's hear your
view.
And I, at least more importantly, I don't think Locke agreed with that. So as Locke presents it, and it seems to me a plausible presentation, it's the attempt to impose religious orthodoxy that puts religion at risk. It sets some people against the religion because of the effort to coerce their belief, and it makes people believe that surface professions of faith or surface acts of worship, that these are all that's required of one. Locke wants to open up for, more sincere investigation by each person of what is true in religion, what is acceptable to God in religion. And he believes, at least he claims to believe, that leaving religion free is likely to produce more of a sincere kind of belief, more of a sincere kind of practice of religious worship than we find in the attempt to impose religion on people. And it's going to produce at the same time more civil peace, in that you're not requiring people to worship in ways that they don't actually accept. So I think all around, I think Locke would say it doesn't make sense to say that this practice of toleration is indeed hostile to religion. It's friendly to religion.
And the other controversy, both in academic circles and politically in America in recent years, related to the letter concerning toleration. I'll paraphrase it this way. You know, the lesson is if we don't study Locke, we don't understand our own current controversies. You know, so to paraphrase that idea, you know, we may not be interested in Locke, but Locke's interested in us and knows more about what we're doing now than we do. It's the question of Catholics. So it's a phenomenon, for whatever reason, that many senior appellate judges, including on the Supreme Court in recent decades, have been Catholic. It's a curious mm-hmm. phenomenon in America. But at one time, mm-hmm. all the nine justices mm-hmm. on the Supreme Court were either Jewish or Catholic, mm-hmm. and there weren't any Protestants.
Right.
And we'd sort of forgotten this controversy from the 17th century and the 18th century about, is Catholicism friendly to, compatible with these concepts of liberal constitutional democracy that come from Locke and then from Montesquieu. And so Locke has some pretty pointed ideas, sometimes not explicitly in the text of the letter concerning toleration, using the word Catholic, but certainly addressing the controversy about Catholics. If the official view of the Catholic Church is intoleration, so to speak, intolerance, mm-hmm. non-toleration, mm-hmm. then what are we arguing for religious toleration and religious liberty? What are we to do with these Catholics we find in our midst? So the accusation is that, well, but the way Locke expresses it, it's anti-Catholic and it's religious liberty for me, but not for thee, is the mm-hmm. criticism. I think mm-hmm. you don't agree with that, but I want mm-hmm. you to tell us what you
well,
think.
One of the things that we need to, when we look back at what Locke says about Catholicism and his reluctance, let's say, to extend religious toleration to Catholics, we need to realize that Catholicism had a different posture towards politics than it mostly does now. So there were doctrines such as you don't need to keep faith with heretics, which meant all Protestants. It meant that at least there were claims that the authority of the Pope superseded the authority of the secular king or the secular authorities altogether. And Locke objected to the political dimensions of those political dimensions of Catholicism, so long as Catholics claimed loyalty to another sovereign beside their own state sovereign, so long as Catholics claim no moral obligation to the authorities of their community and indeed a right to regicide or some such thing. So long as those things were true, to the degree that they were true, Catholicism was a political threat and no more in need of toleration than, let's say, some secular doctrine that would deny the same kind of authority. So Catholicism, I think, no longer has that kind of posture towards politics as it did in Locke's day, or at least as it was alleged to. And therefore, it seems to me Locke's main argument, I mean, Locke has no objection whatever and exceptions for Catholic doctrine, except in these political matters. So when Catholicism is a religion, strictly a religion, he's fine with it. And it's to be as much tolerated as any other. Does that speak to your issue?
Yes. Paul? And there's one other interesting issue about the letter concerning toleration, that the philosophy of natural rights of individuals that Locke conceives and articulates is rooted in the idea that there is a design of nature from a creator, and that design shows itself in the human ordering and the human being, and thus in the making of the social contract. These are natural rights of all individuals. And so in the letter concerning toleration, Locke also says that a legitimate government could say that atheism, per se, is not acceptable, is not within the orbit of this argument of toleration, because that foundational principle of theism, however defined, is so important to the formation and sustaining of this legitimate mode of a political community.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point, especially since there's some critics who say Locke was himself an atheist. I don't know if that's a well-founded view or not, but so if it is, Locke would be making a strong claim. I think we need to understand his position on atheism as follows. What he's opposing is the public preaching of atheism, so to speak.
Yes.
If you're a private atheist, if in your heart you can't get yourself to believe in an atheistic doctrine, Locke would say by one of his main arguments, well, that's you can't force yourself to believe something. You believe what you believe, and therefore that. I don't think he would favor an inquisition or some method of finding secret atheists, but he wants to prevent the spread of public atheism, partly because he believes a belief in God, in a God who supports morality, who underwrites oaths, who underwrites the, moral orientation towards others, and believes perhaps that this God cares about moral behavior on this earth, that he believes this is important for the establishment of a decent society. And as he says, without a belief in God, all is lost, by which he means we can't really count on oaths, which contracts, promises, all kinds of things which society depends upon. We no longer Jefferson. One of the interesting things is that Jefferson, who was very influenced by Locke on the issue of religious toleration, but one of his amendments, so to speak, of Locke was to extend toleration to atheists. As he says in one place, the atheist neither picks my pocket nor...
Yes.
Does something else, I forget now which.
Breaks my leg.
Breaks my leg, okay. So we in America have tended to have a stronger view of toleration than Locke did. But that's relevant, I think, to your earlier question, is Locke hostile to religion? I think not. I think that's one good example where Locke shows more sensitivity and attempt to foster religion than, let's say, present practices would allow.
Well, Locke, in other words, would understand those two opening invocations of a deity, not ever defined as Christian or biblical or anything particular, but the two invocations at the beginning of the Declaration of Independence, right? That the premise of our argument is the laws of nature and nature's God. Mm-hmm. And then the phrase that most people or more people would know, that we hold it to be self-evident that we are endowed by a creator. Mm-hmm. With these natural rights, that Locke would understand a government would not only, or a political community and then a government would not only say these things, but would say, this is our official view of this political community.
They say it in the Declaration. Locke in his philosophy, he defends at the very beginning of the second treatise, he defends the idea of natural rights and a state of nature by appealing to a theistic argument. As he puts it, we are all the workmanship of one creator. And as the workmanship of that one creator, we are his property, whose workmanship we are. And from that, he derives, interestingly, both rights and natural law limitations on the rights. So just as Paul, if I were to take a sledgehammer to your car, I would be violating your property rights, so to speak. So if you were to take a sledgehammer to my head, you would be violating God's ownership rights of me. And therefore, I, in a way, derive a kind of right of immunity from violence or other kinds of impairment by other human beings because I belong to God and I don't belong to you or to any other person. And just as we're limited in our access to the property of others in general, we're limited in our access, in our ability to hinder and affect other human beings. And that's why we're not subject to political authority to start with. That's one of the big arguments that Locke makes in favor of that position.
So in a way, these critics of Locke that I've been trying to bring into our conversation about his philosophy being too individualistic or hostile to religion, they do us the favor of giving us an opportunity to say, oh, okay, well, let's look at Locke. Let's read Locke. Let's talk about Locke. Let's see if your argument has any merit, right?
Well, there's there's an amazingly, I'd say, selective reading of Locke, where many parts of Locke are just omitted from these discussions. Indeed.
Thanks, guys. I think that's a wrap. A big thanks to Professor Carice and Professor Zuckert for joining me today. You can check out our film, The Philosophers Behind the Founders, on YouTube, Facebook, or on our website at fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. For more episodes, subscribe to the FedSoc Films podcast on your favorite platform. Thanks for listening. As always, the Federalist Society doesn't take any positions on the issues discussed. And cut.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.